proud to say this is on the first time I've been able to announce this is here on your show, that just within the last few hours, we obtained a preliminary injunction against the Biden-Harris Plan C to quote unquote cancel student loan debt. This is personal for folks like you and me. I paid for my school in an ROTC scholarship and on a post 9/11 GI Bill. And it was a privilege to get to pay for my schooling in blood, sweat, and tears in service to our nation. And I have friends that did it the same way who didn't come home from Iraq. What are you going to tell their widows? What are you going to tell their spouses, their families? What are you going to tell the working families here in Missouri and across the nation who didn't go to school because they had to go to work? So I'm not going to let Joe Biden and Kamala Harris saddle working families with Ivy League debt. And again, that costs you and me. We're ending up paying for other people's loans that they took out. And there's no congressional, there's no legal authority for the president to do that. Congress has the power of the purse under our Constitution, not the president. And even if the president were going to do this, he would have to publish an administrative rule, and that rule would have to go through a notice and comment period. He did that with Plan A and B, and we got them struck down because they were illegal and unconstitutional. Now with Plan C, not only is it illegal and constitutional, but he's also avoiding that procedural posture because he doesn't want us to see it because he's so embarrassed that he keeps losing in court. And yet here we are today winning again, getting that injunction against Biden Harris's attempt to redistribute your wealth to pay off student loan debt. Let's go!
Welcome back, everybody, to I Came With Fire podcast. Today, we have a special guest, Attorney General Andrew Bailey from the state of Missouri. It is an honor to be able to talk to you. I appreciate you coming on with us, and I know we're going to have a really interesting conversation on some topics that are dear to a lot of Americans. So,
man, it's a privilege to be on the show. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You're definitely a man that really doesn't need any sort of introduction, but I know you have a veteran background and would just like to capture some of that and let you introduce yourself just a little bit for people, and then we'll jump into some of the more juicy stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I grew up here in Missouri. Missouri's home for me, and I went to the University of Missouri in 1999 on an Army ROTC scholarship, planned on going to law school and being a JAG attorney. 9/11 happened, plans changed, volunteered for Armor Branch. I was trained on the M1 Abrams main battle tank at Fort Knox, Kentucky, was assigned to the last heavy armored cavalry regiment in the Army, the 3rd ACR at Fort Carson, Colorado, immediately deployed to Iraq, met the unit over there, and was assigned as an armored cavalry scout platoon leader. So I had about 6 Bradley fighting vehicles, 30 soldiers, was stationed in the Nineveh province, and participated in Operation Restore Riots, one of the larger offensive operations of 2005 to reclaim the city of Talifar, Iraq, from insurgent control, secured the national constitutional referendum, screened the Syrian border, secured the small town we were in. And it was just a troop-sized, company-sized element on a small FOB out in the middle of the Nineveh province. But, you know, it's a privilege to get to lead soldiers like that. Came home from that deployment. They moved my unit to Fort Hood, Texas. We drew all new equipment, all new soldiers, trained for a year, immediately deployed to Iraq again. This time I was in the Key West, kind of just south of Mosul on the in the Tigris River Valley. And 15-month deployment after 455 days, came home, transitioned out of the Army. I worked as an armed guard at a courthouse in inner city St. Louis for about a year, and then went back to the University of Missouri on the post 9/11 GI Bill. So paid for my school in blood, sweat, and tears. And again, it was a privilege to get to do that.
Absolutely.
Look, I always wanted to be a prosecuting attorney. My grandfather worked in law enforcement, so wanted to work with police to lock bad guys up and keep streets safe and find justice for victims. Ended up as a prosecuting attorney in Warren County, Missouri, and would have done that job the rest of my life. I'd married a gal from Texas that I met when I was in the Army there, and we ended up adopting kiddos. And then when you go from no kids to multiple kids overnight, suddenly the bills start adding up. Couldn't afford to be an assistant prosecutor anymore. Went to work at the Missouri Department of Corrections on June 1st, 2018, same day that our governor took office, when the previous governor resigned. So when our Governor Parson took office, he didn't have a staff. So he saw me working at DOC, pulled me up to be on his staff. I was with the governor for a little over 3 years, happened to be at the right place at the right time when my predecessor, Eric Schmidt, was elected to the United States Senate. So Governor Parson appointed me to fill out the remainder of Senator Eric Schmidt's term as AG. And we just won a primary on August 6th to run for a term in our own right. And we'll be facing a Democrat in the general election in November. So we're hard at it. But look, been on the job for just about 2 years now. I've been fighting and winning for Missourians. I'm really proud of the work that my office has done. And it's not me. It's my staff. It's the folks around me. But, you know, being able to assemble a team and lead a team that delivers excellence in all we do. And I'm just, again, really proud of the issues we've been able to take on and attack and be able to deliver wins.
No, definitely. First and foremost, you know, thank you for your service. And then what you're doing and continuing service by going after a lot of these things that are happening to Americans, especially Americans on really the conservative side of the aisle as well, some of the censorship, and we'll get into that. But this is stuff that here on our podcast we've experienced as well with YouTube, you know, Spotify. One of the examples recently is people are trying to follow us, but then finding out that they are unfollowed. And would they have to keep going back? And then I've had some, you know, some content taken down, especially content or an episode I did with a great friend of mine who refused the vaccine and is going through. Really, what we did was just capture what happened between him and his chain of command. No real like medical information, but that episode was taken down for medical misinformation, even though there was none. Right. So this is a theme. It's become a trope now. We've been saying it on this channel, like so many other channels for so long, that conservative voices, people that are, or, you know, anti taking the vaccine or at least having a discussion about what we're doing with it, were censored and attacked. And we're seeing a lot of that come out now that, hey, a lot of these people have been right. Could you jump into the Missouri v. Biden case and just talk about what you're doing? Because it's outstanding work.
Yeah, Missouri v. Biden is really one of the most important First Amendment suits in this nation's history. As your audience knows, the First Amendment protects our right to free speech, and it protects not only speakers, but listeners' rights to hear as well. And the whole concept behind the First Amendment, the whole reason it's a timeless principle of freedom, is that the Founding Fathers understood that it was essential to ordered liberty and a democratic republic to have a free, fair, and open marketplace of ideas where the competition of ideas would result in the people finding consensus around the truth. It's not up to the big tech oligarchs, and it's certainly not up to government bureaucrats to determine what is and isn't true or to empower themselves to protect us from misinformation. That's what Stalinist Russia did, or what George Orwell, right, like on his most creative day, could not have contrived the vast censorship enterprise under which we now live. This is an important suit. We've uncovered, we did merits, a preliminary discovery to get a preliminary injunction, and have uncovered a relationship of coercion and collusion between the federal government across a spectrum of bureaucratic agencies targeting conservative voices for censorship on big tech social media platforms. The case sat at the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court for over a year based on the evidence we had obtained, 20,000 pages of documents, numerous depositions. And then the Supreme Court said, well, look, you've established that the government censored speech in violation of the First Amendment, but the evidence that you have is limited to the years 2020 and 2021. Well, again, that's because the case sat for a year waiting on appellate review. The court ordered us back down to the trial court level. And just within the last 2 weeks, the United States District Court has ordered discovery to move forward. We are pressing ahead and are going to use this lawsuit to continue to root out the vast censorship enterprise and put a stop to it, to protect our right to free speech and protect not only your voice, but your audience's First Amendment right to hear your voice.
Right. No, I mean, that's amazing. There's not a lot of people in your position I see. I mean, there's, you guys are sharing this loss with the Louisiana, say Louisiana as well, Jeff Landry, and some other states, but it's great to see somebody leading the charge. And I'm just curious, what sort of evidence, first off, that you brought to court, and then what sort of evidence has come out since then? I know you're probably waiting still for more evidence, but I mean, there's been some stuff that we've seen that was open source, right? So the Twitter files, Mark Zuckerberg recently just published that letter, or his legal team published that letter. If you could expand again on like the evidence and then what the ramifications of like that letter that Mark Zuckerberg put out recently are in the grand scheme for your case.
Yeah, we can show emails from the White House chief of communications, digital communications, demanding that a Tucker Carlson video or a Tommy Lahren post be removed, stating that the demands are coming from the very top, emphasis on very top levels of the White House, demanding that anyone that questions the vaccine be de-emphasized, deplatformed, shadow banned. We can show you in the evidence that the vast censorship enterprise grew rapidly. In other words, it started at the White House, but it spread across a spectrum of bureaucratic agencies. And the volume of censorship demands the federal government was placing on big tech were so, it was so great, that volume was so great, that the federal government had to design a new bureaucratic apparatus to manage the censorship demands. And they housed it in the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency within Department of Homeland Security. So here is, you know, Department of Homeland Security stood up in the wake of 9/11 to protect us from foreign attacks. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, intended to protect computer software and roads and bridges from terrorist attack. And here the government is being weaponized to violate our First Amendment right to free speech. And the director of CISA's response was, well, there's neurological infrastructure as well. Like, what? Like, she's that dedicated to controlling what we think that she's going to control what we say and hear? I mean, that's exactly what they were doing. But then you're right. I mean, look, Congressman Jim Jordan's efforts have exposed emails from within big tech social media, where the big tech oligarchs certainly understood that they were being that the censorship was being demanded at the behest of the federal government, and that the censorship was going beyond the corporation's own censorship policies. In other words, the corporate censorship's bad enough, but it stopped here, and the federal government pushed them further. And again, that establishes the First Amendment violation. Certainly the Zuckerberg letter and the Twitter files just corroborate all the other aforementioned evidence. And I am confident we will find more evidence as we commence merits discovery. Show me one time in history where the federal government begins trampling on individuals' rights and then recedes on their own without some kind of forcing function. This lawsuit has to be the forcing function. And I think we can use it to build a wall of separation between tech and state to forever protect our First Amendment rights to free speech.
So you said build a wall. What does that sort of infrastructure look like, with also kind of protecting, you know, the people's rights, and then how it pertains to businesses that want the same rights as people, right? For like political funding and to be able to say they can do this stuff. Because there is sort of a dichotomy there in like the First Amendment with corporations and then them wanting some of those same rights, but not wanting to abide by the same rules, right? So what does that infrastructure look like, that wall you're talking about?
Well, I think the wall of separation I'm talking about, again, is looking at a permanent injunction against government coercion of big tech social media. And let me go back to the evidence again, because that was I did not finish answering the first question. If you look at the evidence, and the district court judge who reviewed the evidence explicitly found this, that 100% of the voices that were silenced in violation of the First Amendment, guess what? Conservative voices. So this is core political speech that they're silencing. They're trying to drive people like you and me out of public discourse. And 100% of the speech that was censored as untruthful was actually factually truthful. So like it is the you know, this kind of idea that they're going to protect us from misinformation is in and of itself misinformation. But the wall of separation needs to be a permanent injunction issued by the court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals and ultimately the Supreme Court. I think there needs to be, you know, we need to continue to use the court process, potentially a court-appointed monitor to monitor the government's compliance with court orders. I think Congress has a role to play here with an inspector general that would go in and, again, monitor compliance with the court order. And I think that Congress should eliminate funding from any governmental agency that is willfully defying a court order or violating our constitutional rights. And I think ultimately we need to relook Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And I think that's where you pivot from government coerced censorship to corporate censorship. And as you and your audience know, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is really the federal statute that allowed this big tech oligarchy to form. And it creates a marketplace that is unresponsive to the normal market impulses that would protect against government censorship. And it centralizes control and power in the hands of a very few who are then easily manipulated and coerced by the federal government into achieving this censorship enterprise. Yeah. I think that at the end of the day, the censorship that is going on is more pernicious and dangerous than at any point in human history. And here's why. When King George shut down a printing press, the whole world saw that he had done it, and he was only really silencing the written word, one medium of communication. When the big tech oligarchs, at the government's behest or otherwise, turn dials and de-emphasize deplatform shadow ban, not only will the speaker not necessarily know that their voice is being muted, but the listeners may not understand that their access to that voice has also been muted. So it's a clandestine form of censorship, and it's more than one medium of communication. It's the written word. It's the spoken word. It's non-verbal body language. It's images. And so the censorship that's going on is much more clandestine, nefarious, and dynamic than at any point in our nation's history or in world history, human history. I think it's dangerous because the oligarchs want to forever change our culture, and they're going to do it turning dials of censorship on big tech.
Totally. Going back to something you said about the free marketplace of ideas, this is like speaking to influences on our founding fathers, John Stuart Mill, right? The Enlightenment, John Locke. These are all principles that if you understood where the founding fathers were when they were creating our founding documents, you would get why all of this is not just the antithesis of what America is meant to stand for. It's bad for everybody, right? Any idea that enters that marketplace should be attacked or at least criticized. And if it's a good idea, if it's a bad idea, whatever, it will land where it needs to land. And that's the whole point. And when you're attacking these ideas, you're trying to censor them. What you're doing is you're creating a parallel marketplace for those ideas, right? And you're also sort of saying, hey, this is a taboo idea, and you're driving people to it anyway. It's the Streisand effect, if you're familiar with it, right? That, okay. And all it does is create this black marketplace sort of ideas for people to go, and it's not actually achieving the goal that it is meant to achieve, which is censorship and which is not good. But
yeah.
Some of the things I want to ask you, because you're going after as well, Dr. Anthony Fauci for the origins of COVID and all of that. What sort of evidence do you guys have that you're bringing to the table to go after this? Because this is something that's dear to me as well, because I was, you know, leading airmen when I was still in the military up until recently. And then having conversations with them about the vaccine and, you know, if it was still approved and whether they wanted to take it and all this stuff. So where specifically are you guys, the angle you're coming at him from for this lawsuit?
Well, we know that Dr. Anthony Fauci lied to the American people and aided in the censorship enterprise. You know, he claimed to not really understand social media, and yet we've got these examples where he was communicating with very top level officials in the big tech oligarchy during the COVID pandemic. You know, I would point to COVID as the Trojan horse that got the enemy behind the gates. You know, censorship was a thing, and it's always been counterproductive, like you said. And to your point about kind of the original understanding, you know, the remedy for disfavored speech in this country is counter speech, not censorship. The censorship itself, like you said, and I totally agree, it's counterproductive. But Dr. Fauci, I believe, engaged in some level of censorship by suppressing ideas that he was disinterested in or that were counterproductive to his narrative. You know, he claimed to himself be the science when in fact the science that he was purporting or was espousing has been disproven and largely discredited. And so many other voices, so many other medical professionals, scientists' voices that could have helped people make individual healthcare decisions were suppressed. And those are also the private plaintiffs in the lawsuit. It's Missouri and Louisiana. And my good colleague, Liz Merle, who's now the AG in Louisiana, is you know, a great partner in this case, but it's the private plaintiffs as well. And again, this is about, to your point, allowing people to make good individual healthcare decisions based on access to information. But if COVID is the Trojan horse, the enemy's already behind the gates. They use COVID as an emergency that would justify censorship, but they're not going to stop. And they'll just declare some other emergency to keep it going. And the Constitution doesn't bend in the face of an emergency. That's when we should be most vigilant in the protection of our individual rights. The whole idea is that those rights come from God, not man. And the Constitution exists to protect us from the government.
Right. I think you made a great point earlier when you were talking about bureaucrats, because a lot of the people that were making decisions for us during that time period were people who were unelected and were just given this authority. What sort of ramifications or what sort of actions are you guys taking to sort of mitigate and then maybe reduce the number of bureaucratic involvement in these decisions that affect people's lives in ways that people have no say in the decisions these guys are making?
Yeah. And to your point, we've got more than 50 lawsuits pending right now against the federal government, many of which are based on federal overreach. And when we're talking about that, it's important to juxtapose that against the not only the rights in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, but the founders understood that a federal government of limited authority and that authority be diffused over three co-equal branches of government maximized individual liberty. And so each individual, the three branches of federal government have a role to play. You know, Congress makes the rules, the president enforces the rules, and then the courts interpret the rules. Well, when you've got this unelected fourth branch of government in the alphabet soup of agencies, EPA, uh, DHS, DOJ, ATF, Department of Education, Department of Labor. You have all these unelected bureaucrats. I mean, at some point, it's like a government welfare job that these people just show up and turn on the lights at the beginning of the day and turn off the lights at the end of the day. And in the meantime, they try to find ways to screw with you in your daily life. But yeah, I mean, we have shined the light of truth on it, which is that these people actually have no real authority. Congress can't divest its rulemaking authority to the executive branch. And the executive branch, certainly in the face of the overturning of the Chevron doctrine, has no authority to interpret the law. That's the judiciary's, you know, that third co-equal branches of government's role. And again, these are timeless fundamental principles that are designed to protect us from the government. That's why these lawsuits are so important. And we'll continue pushing those forward and fighting back against any form of government overreach, but especially in the context of kind of that unelected fourth branch of government in the administrative state. I think attorneys general are really the vanguard in the fight against the rise of the administrative state.
I totally agree. The more power that the states have and less that the federal government has is better for everybody personally. But it's crazy to me when you look back and think about some of the authority and power that were given to these agencies. You know, they had federal agencies that were telling, owners of houses, you know, landlords that they had to sustain on collecting rent and things like that. And these are things that they should have no authority over, just as an example. Right. The issue, I think, too, deeply is that there's a lot of people who are frustrated with the amount of control that the government has over their lives. And one of the ways that you're talking about doing this is giving more government control to be able to mitigate some of the big tech censorship and the oligarchy, like you said. How do you sort of justify the dichotomy in giving and having more government power to control something, and then for the people who are worried about it in general, more power the government has? Does that make sense?
Well, I think, yeah, no, absolutely. I think number one, what we've learned over the past 4 years, the administrative state was always bad. That was a form of soft despotism that defied the structure of our constitutional democratic republic. It certainly defied the 10th Amendment. And don't forget the 10th Amendment, to your other point, is that you know, any authority not given to the federal government or deprived to the states is enjoyed by the states and the people of the states. And what I'm saying is that let's give the power back to the people, take it away from the bureaucrats, give it back to the people. Let's slash and burn that alphabet soup of federal bureaucratic agencies. Get rid of them. Eliminate them once and for all. I think that's a role Congress can play to reassert its own authority. Honestly, when have you ever seen a government agent not want to reassert their own authority? And I would think Congress would have an interest in that. But, you know, also reinvigorating the 10th Amendment and the people's right to have a responsive government at the state level. When it comes to the big tech oligarchy, again, I think we just need some system correction to adjust the marketplace to make the marketplace function correctly. I don't think we need government control of big tech. I think that's what led to the vast censorship enterprise that violates the First Amendment. What I want to see happen is Section 230 of the CDA be amended. So 230 of the CDA provides both a sword and a shield to the big tech oligarchies. It's a shield in the sense that it shields them from civil liability as publishers. So the things that are said on their platforms, they're not liable for. But it also explicitly allows them to censor. Congress should go in, take a pen, and strike through those words in Section 230 of the CDA that explicitly allow censorship. I think states also have a role to play with antitrust actions and or consumer protection enforcement to stop the, again, clandestine turning of the dials that shadow ban, deplatform, deemphasize, censor your and my voices, your audience's ability to hear from you. And I think we can do that by pointing to, like, for instance, I can't go to the supermarket and buy anything on that shelf without it having a label to tell me what's in it. Well, then why can't we understand what the censorship policies are and then have some forcing function that the corporations actually abide by their what they're publishing as their policies? And I think that's the rub as I see it today.
My question, to go back to what you were saying about antitrust and then the state's roles, are you specifically talking about how as the owner of like Google or any of these other big conglomerations, that you are beholden to shareholders and the money that you're making them by owning this platform and running this platform? Is that the sort of antitrust involvement with the states that you're referring to, and how the money basically is driving a lot of these decisions, ads, marketing, all of these things? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I think the money is absolutely driving those things. And the pursuit of profits under a pure capitalist system is not inherently bad or evil. In fact, that's the best way to maintain a free society. However, when you have market manipulations, For instance, where you have, where's it, what's the best place to hide a dead body? On page two of a Google search? I mean, when you have these oligarchies that are so big that they can essentially eliminate competition by forming combinations and restraint of trade, I think that's where it becomes problematic. And states have an enforcement authority there. You've seen the federal government use their antitrust authority to go after Google. I think they're doing it incorrectly and improperly. And I think the federal government is merely trying to do a power grab for the federal government's sake, or in retaliation, but potentially in retaliation for big tech not agreeing to their censorship demands. What I'm talking about is a much more noble pursuit, which is to ensure that the marketplace is performing correctly. And I think you start with consumer protection. And if that doesn't work, then you start looking at antitrust. But again, you're targeting any kind of combination in restraint of trade.
Yeah. So we have a really good friend of this channel. He's an Air Force Special Operations vet. But he recently, he does a lot of content on YouTube. It's gun related. He recently just started moving over to Rumble because YouTube is totally changed up the way it allows these guys to collect money from, for his instance, like gun companies and things like that. So they find a lot of ways to manipulate people and try to force them into different content. And, you know, fortunately for him, he's one of those people that isn't going to compromise himself and back down from it. And fortunately, there are platforms like Rumble who were happy to onboard him and take him over there and then give him the license to run his channel the way he wanted to. But it's just, I say that to give another example, just how they're manipulating people into censorship or to censoring themselves, because he could just as easily say, well, I'm going to continue doing this in a muted fashion. But he refuses to. Right. If I could take you back to the you're talking about the Chevron earlier, could you maybe give a deeper explanation on that and what it means? Because I know that that's something that gets thrown around, but not a lot of people understand what that means. And there's a lot of arguing that goes on around it, I think, because of the misunderstandings.
No, I'm happy to, man. Allow me to nerd out for a second here on a like niche Please. Area of admin law. But honestly, it has constitutional ramifications. That's why it's important to your audience, to you and me. But okay, so in the early 1900s, as you saw the federal government try to respond to things like the rise of railroads or labor laws, or you saw the federal and state government try to start making these bureaucratic agencies that would then regulate on the government's behalf. So it's a governmental agency, but it kind of looks a little bit like it's in the executive branch, but kind of looks a little bit like the legislative branch, but also has an interpretive function like the judicial branch. And so early on, the court system, specifically the federal court system, didn't know how to address challenges to these administrative agencies. So the court largely struck them down under what was called the non-delegation doctrine, essentially saying, well, Congress can't give rulemaking authority to the executive branch of government. Congress can't delegate its authority. It's constitutionally vested in Congress. And that largely worked until the 1930s. FDR comes to power in the wake of the Great Depression and creates these new government programs and has this, again, this creates this enormous alphabet soup of federal administrative agencies that's just intended to respond to the Great Depression. So, you know, we have an economic crisis. So FDR wants to throw government at the problem, and he complains that the court keeps striking down his legislation and his government agencies. So he threatens to then pack the court to gain their compliance. They then reverse course. I think one of the first acts that they reversed course on was the Social Security Act, actually. And so the court started kind of deferring and allowing these agencies to pop up and exercise rulemaking authority. And then the jurisprudence was really schizophrenic and kind of scattershot for the next 50 years. And you get to the 1980s, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist takes over as Chief Justice of the court. And he's dedicated to finding some consensus. Like at the end of the day, he wants to have majority opinions that are clear and concise, that reestablish the rule of law. So there's a fixed point, and the marketplace can, and individuals can operate around a fixed point in the law. And so they come up with this kind of compromise decision in which the company Chevron, the oil company Chevron, was one of the parties in the case. So that's why it's called Chevron deference, because Chevron was one of the named parties in the case. But in 1985, the Chevron decision is handed down, and it says that the federal judiciary will defer to a federal agency's reasonable interpretation of their statutory authority. So Congress passes a law that empowers the EPA to regulate water under the Clean Water Act, and the federal courts are then supposed to defer to the EPA bureaucracy's reasonable interpretation of their authority under the Clean Water Act. So take, for instance, their authority to regulate the navigable waters of the United States. Well, eventually you get from 1985 to like 2005, And the EPA says, well, navigable water means any water on the planet Earth, underground, in the sky, running water that we can put a boat on, doesn't matter, any water. If you've got a seasonal ditch on your farm that just, you know, has water in it occasionally, well, we're going to regulate that. And you can't use that property anymore without getting permission from us. Oh, and by the way, the courts defer to our interpretation. And this was never good for our democratic republic. Again, it allowed, it protected and kind of grew this mushrooming of the federal bureaucracy. And it really undermined the court's role. And again, if you look at the three co-equal branches of government, one of them makes the rules, the other one enforces the rules, and the courts interpret the rules. Well, if you're deferring to the executive agency's interpretation, you're kind of foregoing your role, right, which is to interpret the rules. So just this last term, the United States Supreme Court overturned the Chevron case, rejected the Chevron doctrine, said, no, federal bureaucrats don't get to interpret their own rules. The federal courts are going to fulfill their role within the separation of powers. And so that's going to help give state attorneys general and individual plaintiffs legal authority to go in and, again, start slashing and burning some of that regulatory state and reemphasize Congress's role in passing clear, concise, and consistent legislation.
No, absolutely. I mean, I feel like you could probably go in and cut a third of the bureaucratic jobs in our government and nothing would change. Sort of like Elon taking over Twitter. He cut, what was it, like 80% of the people that work there. And really, it runs more efficiently than it did before. I mean, that helps, too, when they're not actively looking for people to censure on Twitter or X now anyway. Right. But that's a great point. I'm just curious now with the conversation on censorship, have you seen what came out yesterday with Tenet Media and then like Dave Rubin, Tim Pool? Have you seen that essentially saying that they under FARA were taking money from the Russian government to basically push propaganda? Have you seen that that just came out yesterday?
I haven't. I have not seen that. But I'll tell you, like, yeah, you know, we keep I have seen in the news, you know, the Biden-Harris administration is blaming Iran and Russia for spreading disinformation, this, that, the other thing. Mm-hmm. You know, again, without censorship, this wouldn't be a problem because people will sort out whether or not something is truthful or what is and isn't information, disinformation based on conversations like these. I mean, that's the whole point.
Right. I mean, and you've been in the military and you're in government, right? How many times have you gotten only a piece of the pie on information? And then what do people do when they're given just a piece of it? They fill in the gaps, and it's typically with the worst things that they can think of because they get anxiety about thinking about it or whatever, you know? So this is just what happens. This is the consequences of your actions, so to speak, of dealing with trying to eliminate information, trying to censor people, and not giving the full scope of what's going on. But one of the things I experienced when COVID was happening in the military was the extremism stand downs, the DOD extremism stand downs. Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with the term. Yeah.
Yeah. They went around again, and I'll speak to like what I experienced. You know, we had a briefing at my guard mount from, you know, group wing leadership, which is base leadership in the Air Force, and discussing certain things that, you know, talking about how there's a white supremacy problem and how certain maybe American historical iconography is not okay anymore. So like the Gadsden flag, anything like that. The Peel to Heaven flag was another one. So we had all these briefings, and then, you know, I was an NCO. And I had airmen that lived in the barracks, and we were instructed to go with, you know, the command staff leadership to walk through these rooms and look around for some of this iconography or maybe anything that we thought could be a sign of extremism, right? Going, and obviously when you live in the barracks, you know, that's not yours, and you know, the government can go through, or the, you know, the military goes through, and there's not any sort of breach of rights there. But another thing that was going on too is there were my commander was handing out license plates of vehicles that he'd kind of gone around and collected and had seen iconography on it that he felt like was extremist, and was telling our patrolmen to go, because I was security forces, military police, to go around and find these vehicles and then basically give the owners a 72-hour period to have it removed, and then there would be a follow-up, right? So I would like to talk about how I know there are certain ways that your rights are limited once you join the military, because you are now, you know, a member of the federal government, so to speak. But in what way does that sort of stuff like actually violate rights? Because I feel like this goes under, you know, the umbrella of what we're talking about, censorship, conservative ideas. And then also too, this is, I feel like a tertiary issue that ties into the recruiting crisis that they're experiencing, but that's a whole nother conversation. But you know, the extremism stand down, I'd like to get your opinion on it and sort of what that means, the overarching meaning.
Look, the Biden-Harris administration has turned the military woke. I mean, the military is supposed to fight and win wars on land and air and the sea, right? And instead, we're more focused on this kind of nonsense. And I worry about the training and readiness and preparedness of our armed forces, because we're spending time, instead of being at the rifle range or going through, you know, performing common tasks or shooting gunnery or doing other things, we're focused on this kind of nonsense. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. At the end of the day, you don't forego your right to conscience when you join the military. Certainly, you're making yourself subservient to the greater good when you volunteer to serve in the military, but you don't forego your right of conscience. So this is absolutely ludicrous. It's absolutely insane. You know, I'm really proud to live in the state of Missouri, where my predecessor, Eric Schmidt, has really taken the chain of command and the Department of Defense to task over these issues, saying, well, why are we funding your why are we funding these kinds of programs? And what are you doing? What are you missing out on? What are you supposed to be doing instead with the time and resources we've given to you? And so I think that's an important line of effort.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I know for a fact that whole extremism stand down thing, and then coupled with everything that a lot of military members went through with COVID, is a big reason why I ended up separating at 14 plus years. And then I have friends who made the decision to get out as well. So it just, again, you know, going back to what the whole overarching theme of this conversation is that there are a certain brand of people, for the most part, that exist in the military. And anybody who's served knows you tend to be more conservative than anything, right? Whether or not it's a concerted effort to sort of weed out those people, you know, we can have a discussion on that. I do think that there is a concerted effort personally to weed out some of those people. And if you have some thoughts on that, you're more than welcome to give them. But yeah, it looked like you had something to express.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, the military is one of the last organizations that teaches like rational thought, abstract problem solving, personal accountability. You know, all those three things are antithetical to the modern woke progressive left. And when you have a modern woke progressive leftist administration at the top of the chain of command with President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, this is the byproduct of that. And it's going to absolutely ruin our United States military. This is an entity that so many of us take pride in, that's been the bulwark of freedom for our country. And is now that reputation is being tarnished under the poor stewardship of the Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other things that you're going after is student loan debt as well. This is a conversation that I know, I mean, I had student loan debt when I got out of college. I knew full well when I took it, you know, my dad made sure I knew too at the time, hey man, you know, you're taking on all this debt, like you're going to have to pay it off, right? That that's just the way it should be, I feel. But could you jump into the lawsuits there? It's a couple of different states again, like the censorship one, but just kind of explain what it is and then some of the ramifications that are coming down from it.
Yeah, I've been at the forefront of this issue since I took office back in January of 2023. 1 month later, I was at the United States Supreme Court at counsel table representing the state of Missouri, fighting back against the Biden-Harris Plan A to cancel, quote unquote, cancel student loan debt. Any working family and small business owner out there will tell you there's no such thing as debt cancellation. Somebody pays it off.
Right.
It would have cost us about $500 billion, would have cost Missouri taxpayers north of $44 million. So we were integral to getting that, getting a win there, putting a stop to it, and getting a court order to end President Biden and Kamala Harris's Plan A to, quote unquote, cancel student loan debt under the HEROES Act of 2006. And that opinion was handed down by the United States Supreme Court in June of 2023. Well, then in 2024, Biden-Harris roll out Plan B. I lead a coalition of states and file suit here in the state of Missouri to put a stop to Plan B. We got an injunction at the district court level that was upheld at the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. And just within the last 2 weeks, the United States Supreme Court upheld that injunction as well. If you go back to the original case with Plan A, what the court said, and this is under the major questions doctrine, the court said that, look, Congress doesn't hide an elephant in a mouse hole. If Congress intends to grant the president authority to redistribute $500 billion, implement a program of this enormous economic, sociopolitical magnitude, Congress has to speak explicitly. When has Congress passed a bill? Did I miss that? Because I've seen Congress twice reject such a bill. Congress has not passed such a bill authorizing the president or vice president to do this. So then we win. We defeat their plan A. We defeat their plan B. Well, now we uncover that they've come up with plan C, and this time they're not even publishing it. I mean, it's bad enough when they're doing it, but at least they're publishing rules where we can see the rule, understand the contours, and craft our lawsuit to file suit against it. We uncovered communications that have demonstrated the federal government is already demanding under this secret plan C now that the lenders start canceling the debt. And so we filed suit. We moved for an injunction. I'm proud to say this is on the first time I've been able to announce this is here on your show, that just within the last few hours, we have obtained a preliminary injunction against the Biden-Harris Plan C to quote unquote cancel student loan debt. This is personal for folks like you and me. I paid for my school in an ROTC scholarship and on a post 9/11 GI Bill, and it was a privilege to get to pay for my schooling in blood, sweat, and tears in service to our nation. And I have friends that did it the same way who didn't come home from Iraq. What are you going to tell their widows? What are you going to tell their spouses, their families? What are you going to tell the working families here in Missouri and across the nation who didn't go to school because they had to go to work? So I'm not going to let Joe Biden and Kamala Harris saddle working families with Ivy League debt.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, what is the plan here to tell these lenders to eradicate that debt? Is just the federal government is going to subsidize it and pay them back for it on behalf of those people? Is that the plan?
Yeah, that seems to be the plan. And again, that costs you and me. We're ending up paying for other people's loans that they took out. And there's no congressional, there's no legal authority for the president to do that. Congress has the power of the purse under our Constitution, not the president. And even if the president were going to do this, he would have to publish an administrative rule, and that rule would have to go through a notice and comment period. He did that with Plan A and B, and we got them struck down because they were illegal and unconstitutional. Now with Plan C, not only is it illegal and constitutional, but he's also avoiding that procedural posture because he doesn't want us to see it because he's so embarrassed that he keeps losing in court. And yet here we are today winning again, getting that injunction against Biden Harris's attempt to redistribute your wealth to pay off student loan debt.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of this happens because people just don't have a good understanding of the way our own government is supposed to work. I did not get any sort of real civics education when I was going through high school. And I went through DoDEA schools, right? So I went to school on bases. My dad was active duty, but I know plenty of people, my wife, for instance, who went to a regular public high school, and there's just no civics education. There's no understanding of the way the balance of powers is supposed to work. There's no understanding of what the president can and can't actually do as the executive branch. And, you know, I just think that people see these things that are emotionally triggering to them, and they think this is a great idea and don't have any real understanding of how this is going to affect people, the tertiary effects, and there's always unforeseen effects too, but just how this is supposed to work so we can demand a better brand of politician, demand a better brand of governance. And it's just really unfortunate. And fortunately, people like you are out there being the thorn in the side of the government essentially right now and having to do this work, because and it's unfortunate that you do have to do this work, that we've gotten to this point where you are having to do this work. But what sort of pushback, other than obviously, I mean, you're in legal battles, what other sort of pushback are you getting from the federal government and what this is doing, whether it's personal or otherwise? I'd be very interested to know. I mean, I feel like it has to be something.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, the left-wing media despises me because of the positions we take. Again, they think that the ends justify the means. And when I say that, what I mean is they don't care that it's unconstitutional for the president to unilaterally redistribute wealth without any authorizing statutory provisions. All they care is that Biden and Harris remain in power. And so they think it's okay for Biden and Harris to be able to buy off votes to do that. And so like the mainstream media avoids stories like this, or, you know, demonizes myself or my colleagues who are fighting back against stuff like this. But look, I'm proud to be leading this effort. I have no interest in being a politician. I have an interest in being the Missouri Attorney General because I have four small children who I'm raising in my home state. I want them to enjoy the same freedom, safety, and prosperity that this nation was founded upon and that I enjoyed growing up in this state. And if we don't have warriors that are willing to protect those things, we will lose those things. I think we need more veterans in public office. I think that's a good thing for our democratic republic. People who have served and, again, they feel invested in the process and understand that the means are just as important as the ends. And that we do things the right way and we don't cut corners, and that the process matters. And I think those are things you learn in the military, certainly things I learned in the military and things that I bring with me, not only real life leadership and management skills and accountability, but also that process and that discipline. I think those are important for government. I think veterans help provide those.
No, I definitely agree. I think that more veterans should be involved. We've talked to a few who have tried to break into the state level. One of our sponsors, Luis Espindola, he ran in Texas recently, sort of like the people know who Brandon Herrera is more often, right? So it's in this, sort of on the same level. Unfortunately, Luis was unable to achieve the spot and the goal that he wanted to, but the effort is what I think is important as well. And this is sort of a debate. I would like to ask you this question and get your opinion on it. Is on this the show we talk about, should military service be a prerequisite to serving in the federal government or the state or just government in general? My opinion is that I don't think it should be a total prerequisite, but I feel like there should be other avenues of service for the country that specifically the 18 to 22, like college, high school graduate crowd should be able to run down those avenues and provide service to their state and in other ways, right? That isn't military service, because personally don't think everybody belongs in the military. And there are people that I served with that knew they shouldn't be there. Right. But what is your thoughts on that? Should it be a prerequisite of government service? And then do you feel like the idea of having another avenue of civil service for people, specifically the college crowd, is a good idea?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. At the end of the day, I think we should be doing everything we can to incentivize, to promote, to advocate for public service. I think that more youth going into the military gives them an opportunity, again, to experience some discipline, some personal accountability that the normal kind of institutions that would provide those in the community have been under attack and are maybe not performing at the level that they were in past generations. And so the military can help fill that gap. I think we've got to fix the military by getting the woke nonsense, the progressive nonsense, the out of the military and refocus on war fighting. And I think if we do that, we can restore a level of accountability and discipline in our culture. I think that's a good thing. I think that, again, having individuals who have served in that or then move on to public office at the state and federal level is a great and wonderful thing. Not only do they bring those real life leadership and management skills, they bring, rational thought. They bring personal accountability, basic tenets of objective reality that need to be re-injected into our government.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. So is there anything that you've got coming up specifically, like what you're trying to do, or perhaps anything else that you're trying to run down lawsuit wise against the government that maybe hasn't gotten the notoriety that Missouri v. Biden has?
Yeah, I think we're going to undertake some significant efforts to fight back against censorship, not only in the case of Missouri v. Biden, which, by the way, I think that the mainstream media really missed the point in that case. They touted that as a win for the Biden-Harris administration. Well, they can't get around the First Amendment, and they ignored the fact that that case is back down at the trial court level. It wasn't the fact that the court never ruled on the merits. In fact, if anything, we received encouraging indications that the court did find a coercion between the federal government and big tech and wants it to stop. We just need to find more evidence that that censorship's ongoing. You and I know it is. Your audience knows it is. I think fighting back against corporate censorship is also going to be really important as we move forward. And I think you'll see the state of Missouri taking the lead on that. Right now, it being the beginning of September, I've got an election in early November, so we're hard at it. I want to give a shout out to my friends at voteforamerica.org. Absolutely. That's vote number 4america.org. I think, if everyone who believes in the Constitution, everyone who believes in the Second Amendment, if all the veterans out there, if you go register to vote at voteforamerica.org, they can assist you with that. But go one step further. Find a friend, find a colleague, find a battle buddy, register them to vote, and then make sure they go to the polling place in November. If we do that, our voices will be heard. We can make this thing too big to rig. I think that's really important as we march toward November. We'll love folks' support in my campaign as well at baileymo.com. I can use all the help I can get. We need ammunition so we can keep the fight going, the fight against the enemies of freedom, and can prevail in November.
No, absolutely. And good luck to you for sure. We just recently had a conversation with Baker Levitt from Vote for America, and it's an outstanding conversation, really driving home the importance of voting and just exercising your rights in general. I mean, you have these, you were born with them. They're inalienable, God-given rights. And if you're not out there and you're not exercising your rights, you're really wasting something. And that is the truth. It is a waste to not do that. And then the scarier thing, too, is you look at some of these swing states, there are an overwhelming amount of people who are hunters, anglers, gun owners who haven't voted. They're registered to do all these other things, but they don't go vote. And there's a significant amount of them. And if they would have just gone to the polls and voted the last election, it could have swung those states the other way, which is wild, because this is the leave me alone, I just want to be left alone group of people who are now having to deal with the wolves on the doorstep, so to speak, of the consequences of not going out and voting and keeping some of this at bay, you know? So it is, yeah. It is just so important for you to exercise your rights and get out there and do that. I would like to know if you've got to be on other people's radar as well. When I say other people, I mean, you know, maybe the Trump campaign, right? Has anybody from there reached out to you about what you're doing and then offered support or sort of discussed, you know, the future should he end up taking office again?
You know, I've got some great friends who work on President Trump's team. I've had the privilege of meeting with on an individual basis and speaking with the president on the phone. I am supporting President Trump in this election. And I think that President Trump can and will make America great again. I think that he started a movement back in 2016 and expanded the Republican Party into places it never would have gone on its own. And, you know, what a novel concept that we'd have to have a political party that would rally around putting America and Americans first. And yet that's exactly what you and I fought for when we were in the United States military. And it's a breath of fresh air to see someone who's willing to take the fights to the enemy like President Trump. I'm encouraged and excited about the future of our country under his restored leadership. And so that is absolutely who folks need to go support. You know, at the end of the day, I want to serve in whatever capacity is going to do the most damage to the enemy. Put your weapon systems in place to do the most damage to the enemy. And so where can I be a champion and a warrior for freedom, safety, and prosperity? That's where I want to be and where I want to serve. And so that's why I'm running for election as Missouri Attorney General. And again, can use all the help I can get. And if folks are willing to go to baileymo.com and support us, it really puts wind in our sail and means the world to us.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, I really appreciate you coming on and having a conversation with me today. I apologize for on behalf of Chris, my co-host. He's still active duty, so Uncle Sam has his hand on the back of his collar today, unfortunately. But, you know, here we are, and we pressed, and I appreciate your time very much. And it's really insightful to be able to talk to you and listen to what you're doing. And I'd like to say thank you for all the work you are doing for alternative media, right, overall, and then just the American people with government censorship and everything that's going on, because it really is just – some people don't realize it, but it is an attack on all Americans. You don't want to see censorship happening to anybody. And that's a historical lesson here, that eventually it will come for you, and that nobody is safe when the wolves of censorship are out on the prowl. No one is safe. Any idea is up for taking apart, so, and being attacked.
Yeah, I always tell folks, you know, you may not be a constituent of mine, but I can still represent you. And I want to say thank you. God bless you and your audience. Thank you for covering these important issues as we continue to shine the light of truth on this stuff.
I appreciate it, Andrew. And best of luck to you in the election. And you have a great day.
Hey, thanks, man. You too. Talk soon.
Appreciate it.